Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
You're on Team Human, where we challenge the operating systems driving our society, reveal the embedded codes, and share strategies for sustainable living, economic justice, and preservation of the quirky nooks and crannies that make people so much more than mere programs. This is where the conscious beats the automatic, an intervention by people on behalf of people. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and I'm on Team Human. Playing for Team Human today, Net artist and activist Mushan Zeraviv.
There's something very naive about this idea that we can drive everything out of this abstraction, that we can think of everything through data, through these zeros and ones, and then from that understand it better.
Mushan is going to share new forms of resistance and ways of turning the surveillance industry back on itself. It's time to intervene on behalf of people. This is Team Human. So I'm way less worried about some group of Chinese hackers breaking into my bank account than I am the banks themselves. You know, details have already surfaced and they're out, and we all know now that more than a couple of million unauthorized Wells Fargo bank and credit card accounts were created on behalf of unwitting customers by bank employees trying to cash in on new account bonuses and various incentives. And, you know, the story blew up last month and ultimately led to the CEO of the bank resigning, as if somehow, well, you know, I'm going to fall on my sword and responsibilities with me, so I'll resign. And they're not giving him, you know, some extra millions of dollars. He's going to have to go off with just the tens of hundreds of whatever millions he has. So there's some happiness, I guess, for us in that. But what a resignation like that, and this sort of, well, let's just kind of get back to normal and we're going to be extra good to our customers and we're going to talk to all our employees. You know, what that doesn't really solve is that if you've already fired 5,300 employees for opening up fake bank accounts or extra bank accounts for people and charging them all these extra fees and things, maybe it's not the 5,300 employees who are so wrong, but the underlying system itself. How can this be considered sort of bad actors, these 5,300 of our however many tens of thousands of employees, but rather it's an indication of systemic institutionalized extraction that's been guiding banking for decades, you know, if not much longer, as well as institutionalized cover-up. Some of the bank employees, some of them started emailing me after the revelations came out, partly because of my books, you know, they're generally deconstructing this kind of neoliberal nightmare that a lot of people are trying to live through. And employees emailed me that when they went through their bank training, they were given a phone number to call at central command, you know, at the national headquarters of the bank, a special sort of whistleblower number to call if they felt their branch was doing something that was unethical or that went against the standard things that they were taught in their ethics classes. You know, it was sort of this way you could report on the bank without, you know, having to talk right to your boss. And what the bank ended up doing was a week or two later, employees who called that number and reported something going on at their branch, like opening up fake accounts for little old ladies against their knowledge and then charging them money, those employees ended up being fired. They ended up being let go. So I started to get all these emails from employees who, the few who were not among the 5,300 and other tens of thousands who opened up all these accounts, but the employees who tried to do the right thing, the thing that in theory they were being told, and that right thing feedback channel was being used for the opposite purpose. It was being used to eliminate human intervention, to eliminate any possibility of human self-regulation of this otherwise extractive system. And no, this is not the story of some digital technology thing, you know, going awry. Yes, the digital technology and having records of your banking customers, you know, it amplified these bank clerks' ability to create the fake accounts in volume. You know, they could open up 30 accounts in half an hour instead of doing all the paperwork and filling out cards. And it did distance them a little bit from the repercussions of their actions. You know, they weren't looking at the little old lady's face, you know, when they were stealing $50 a month from her because they just looked like numbers and spreadsheets. But the real driving force here are the incentives. It's both the incentives being given to employees to open up new credit card accounts, no matter the impact on the customers, as well as the incentives given to the banks themselves to further financialize our economy, no matter the impact on our lives and our worlds. So we're not watching an otherwise, you know, just and ethical banking system get corrupted by a single tainted credit card scheme. You know, rather, what we're watching is what we might call extreme capitalism at work. You know, banks don't make money by creating value. They no longer make money by helping people transact. No, they make money by extracting funds from anyone who wants to build a business or even just make transactions. And as long as the economy is growing, more businesses need loans, more people make purchases, and that means banks can continue to grow and please their shareholders, who we all know are addicted to growth and capital gains. But now that the economy is in the doldrums, now that growth is so super, super slow, banks have to resort to extraordinary measures to show growth, the same growth that they used to show. You know, particularly when shareholders can just cash in their banking shares for those of high-tech stocks, which seem to have no problem shooting to the stratosphere, at least at this moment. You know, so to create growth synthetically, banks look to extract more money somehow from the same customers and transactions that are already there. You know, how do you create growth when there's no actual growth? They do it by selling new credit cards and higher fees, new loans with higher origination costs, or just worse terms on existing accounts and debt. How do you sell consumers on higher finance costs for the same old products? Well, there's good marketing in the form of slick TV commercials, and good sales in the form of highly incentivized bank employees. Employees know if they don't meet the quotas on the new accounts by reaching the target set by their managers, then they may be next on the chopping block, right? They'll get layoffs. The bank has to show growth. We're either going to show growth by you getting more accounts one way or another, or by us cutting your job, because then, you know, the $50,000 or $60,000 we pay you, that ends up, you know, no longer taking away from our bottom line. So it's a real prisoner's dilemma that they try to put the employees in. So they think, what's the harm of opening a few new accounts? You know, particularly if everybody's doing it. That's what we call a company culture. Everybody's doing it. Or in this case, really, an industry culture. If you have an account at Wells Fargo, of course, close it and go to a community bank, go to a local bank. But really, if you have an account at any national investment house like Wells Fargo or Chase or Bank of America, these are businesses, these are generic, top-level, global businesses that make their money by extracting value from people and places. If you can't go to a credit union, which you should be able to, but if you don't want to go to a credit union, then at least go to a local savings and loan. The business model of a savings and loan is that they take accounts. You basically borrow money from people. You open up savings accounts for people, and then you use those savings to invest in local businesses and to invest in local mortgages. So the money that you're putting in the bank is being loaned to people who are building things where you live. So it's a circulatory model. You build something where you live, then you spend money there, then they end up putting something in their savings account, then you borrow from that savings account to do something that you need. And it's all circular. Everybody does better. As opposed to banks like Wells Fargo, they're not investing in you. They're not investing in communities. They're extracting all this money and then throwing it into derivatives and treasury bonds and buying money and doing credit default swaps, although they have a different name now, doing all sorts of insane things that don't actually contribute to the circulatory real economy. The only real solution here is for banks, like any businesses, not to be required to grow. Banks, particularly savings banks, are really more like utilities than businesses. You know, with a monopoly power on the ability to issue currency, they're in a unique role to be able to enable businesses of every other kind. This makes them at least as responsible to the public good as to their shareholders. By seeking to extract a higher percentage of our economic activity to pay for their financial services, they don't help anyone. Rather than promoting businesses, the banks serve as drag. Think about that for a minute. The banks are drag on the economy. They're no longer the wells of currency through which we prime the economy. They are the extractive force that slows down an economy. No, banks don't get to grow all the time, no matter what's happening in the real world. It is they who have hacked the economy to all of our detriment, and it's time to reject the premise of growth on which they are based. We're on Team Human, coming to you alive from the Basement Laboratory for Digital Humanism at CUNY Queens and online at teamhuman.fm. Please join Team Human, both as a listener and as a human teammate, or even as a supporter through the donation link at teamhuman.fm. It's not too late to reclaim planet Earth for its people, to give land and labor a voice along with capital, and to share our best strategies for mutual aid, environmental sustainability, and economic justice. In the real world, we humans have the home field advantage. Let's use it. So, you know, I'm teaching at CUNY now, and they've got this big money invested interest in what they're calling digital humanities. And I heard that and I was like, cool, this is us, the digital humanism people and yay. And what they're really doing is, like, you know, using some weird search engine, big data technology to analyze every time that Shakespeare used the word thou in order to know, just really nail down for sure what he really meant and what was going on. Or we're going to look at the entire database of, you know, late Renaissance literature to figure out. It's this almost, you know, that moment when you're going on Wikipedia and there's a term that you're using that turns out there's two articles. And then they say that word that I learned from Wikipedia. We're going to disambiguate this thing. We're going to nail down exactly what it is. It feels like, in some ways, your work is a response to this cold, hard belief that data can somehow put every little person and thing and idea in its proper place, that you're almost trying to mess that up. I mean, is that accurate?
I think
I think it's messed up. I'm trying to fix it, right? There's something very naive about this idea that we can drive everything out of this abstraction, like that we can think of everything through data, through these zeros and ones, and then from that, understand it better. Now, there are things that are very exciting about finding all of the thous. And then you see so much data beyond the amount that you can actually calculate or analyze without computers. And then the computers tell you something that you couldn't tell yourself. And you're like, whoa, I've found the truth that I could have never found otherwise. Now, that creates this cultural or political bias towards what we can calculate, right? That creates a situation where if you can't calculate it, it's secondary.
But you talk about, I mean, you use the term reambiguation.
Yeah.
In other words, as if to make it anomalous, make it strange, make it paradoxical, and thus more human, I think.
It's both more human and kind of pushing the envelope. Creating ambiguous communication and information and culture is in a way saying, yes, it cannot extract the value of being digitized the same way as all of these natively zeros and ones communication that you want us, like likes and whatever, things that are born in data. We want to expand the scope of our life. So your frustration, your technological frustration, is good. Like, you should be frustrated. If you cannot serve life in the way that we want to live it, then it's your problem. We're not going to stop living our lives that way just so you can analyze and digitize it.
So it's a form of both self-assertion and resistance. But what does it look like?
So one of the ways it looks like is a project that I'm doing with Daniel Howe and Helen Nissenbaum. It's called Ad Nauseam. Ad Nauseam is a browser plugin, essentially an ad blocker, that beyond just hiding the ads, it actually goes and clicks each one of them. So every ad that your browser encounters is clicked by this plugin. And what's the meaning of that?
Is it going to open up all the windows in your computer?
It's silently clicking them. So it registers the click with the server. It creates the data of somebody clicked this ad without that actually happening.
So it's both extremes. It's an ad blocker for the user, but it click on everything.
Yeah, omnivorous clicker on the other. And what it creates, basically, is a profile that makes no sense. It's an ambiguous profile. Like, if it makes sense, then it skews the whole data, especially as more and more people do that. And if it doesn't make sense, then they identify this, okay, this doesn't make sense. Let's get rid of this profile. It's broken. So we get the best of both worlds. We don't see the annoying ads, and we perform. We perform to this data mining algorithms that this is what you don't understand. And we're not going to make it easier for you because we are not like you. Another thing there, this approach of resistance to data surveillance, saying you wanted big data, you're so excited about big data, let's see how big can big data really get, right? Everything that has to do with big data has this assumption that all of the data would be useful. At the same time, if we actually perform the way we live our lives, then that becomes much, much harder to survey.
Now, of course, as they get more advanced, they can look at, oh, here's the, 2% of users who use ad nauseum on their browsers. That's a huge data point. Because you can't use it on your GPS yet. You can't. I mean, there's all these other ways that they can still scrape your data.
Well, actually, there are. If you read Helen Nissenbaum and Finn Brenton's book titled "Obfuscation," and they're writing about the technique, and at the same time also featuring a lot of projects, including ones that are obfuscating GPS data. So this is not a singular project. This is what we're trying to present as a wider movement. That is not kind of the crypto culture, I'm going to hide myself, I'm going to hide in a box. No, this is really challenging the premises of big data. Because the problem that I have with crypto culture is that essentially what Google and WikiLeaks are saying is kind of the same. So Google is saying this data represents you, and therefore we should collect all of it and act on it and sell it and so on, sell the analysis or the actions based on it. But crypto culture basically says this data represents you, and this is who you are, and therefore you should hide. What we're
right.
trying
it
to
reifies say, it reifies the importance of the data.
It creates, again, these binaries, these zeros and ones. What we're trying to say, no, this actually does not represent us. It's so far from representing us, but it would represent us if we minimize our lives to that. And that's back to the reambiguation.
Right. Well, if you just play along, then your apps are going to know more about you and deliver you more of what you want. So Google's going to tell you, you know, you've got a meeting in 30 minutes. You better leave now, given current traffic. If you reambiguate all your data, then Google's not going to be able to give you that important, vital fact about your life.
It's true. And I'm not going to say that there's no value in disambiguation. And I think there are things that we can disambiguate now. Traffic is actually one of them, to a large degree. And I've been working with traffic data as well. But to extrapolate from that to everything?
Yeah, but the less of a terrorist risk you are, then the faster airport line we can put you on.
It's true.
So the more data you give us, the more we know that you're not a threat, and the faster travel you can do back and forth to Israel.
Yeah, and then I have nothing to hide, and therefore I'm a...
Yeah.
And I should not have anything to hide, and then we're getting back
but,
to Eric Schmidt's...
Well, you want to hide, it's fine, and just wait on the longer line exactly. of the people who hide stuff.
Exactly. So the amazing achievements, scientific achievements of data analysis and advanced algorithms are extrapolating into culture. You know, it creates these serious people speaking dystopian science fiction as if it's utopia, like the Ray Kurzweils of the world that are self-hating humans, right? They're like, look at this utopia of mass suicide, right? Let's all kill ourselves. And but have floppy disks.
You upload something better, a little, you know, USB drive.
Yeah, it's like like fast, like amazing, zip drives, right?
Yeah, there are computers that will carry on your consciousness after you're gone.
Yeah, your hardware would die, but then you have a backup, so that's fine.
Yeah, at least for your data, but not for your awareness of it is the trick.
But the basic assumption is that. What we've learned that we can do with transportation or you know search engines and stuff like that, that extrapolates to everything. And there's this amazing assertions that if you haven't made yourself machine readable, then there's something wrong with you. There's something wrong with this thing that you're doing. It's not being efficient. It's not fast enough. It's not
and it plays into the youth culture now where kids think. If they haven't gotten likes for something, then it didn't really happen on some level. You know, the question they ask whenever I'm out shooting a documentary, and there's the person that we're shooting, kids always come up. They don't have no idea who it is, but they always ask, is he famous or is she famous? That's all they care about.
Yeah.
Not, is this a singer? What did they do? And even if they are famous. Oh, great. Can I have a selfie with them? Just the fame itself. So... That's a data-driven approach to culture.
Mm-hmm.
If you grow up with that, I'm not sure exactly how we flip that.
So this is a larger cultural process of disambiguating culture, disambiguating education. Like I think, as a parent as well, something that we should explore more widely is how do we have these moments that cannot be easily quantifiable. Now, I'm not saying don't post your images on social media or things like that. I'm definitely not saying not in that camp of hide in a box. I'm just saying this technology is so far from you know what it pretends to be doing that you should not say oh this doesn't count as much as the things that I can quantify. As a designer and a design educator, I'm also, I teach information design. So we teach our students how to analyze the data, how to communicate the data, how to do all of that. But then you get to that point, which is very, very basic. But from that point on, there's so much you should be doing that is based on culture and based on things that cannot be easily quantified. And that's where you shine. You know, there are schools in design that are like, make everything seamless, right? Make experiences seamless. Make sure that the digital surfaces that you're creating or the digital visualizations that you're creating are like machine generated, and there's like this strength and truth in the machine. But there are other approaches in design that are like sinful design, like saying, this is a product that has history. This is a product that has humans that made it. This is the process it was made in. Here are some glitches, not as aesthetics, but glitches as somebody did this. This is not coming from the data coming from the soil of the earth. This has been collected, analyzed, processed, manipulated, and then put you in a perspective that you can respond to it. You can somehow say this is where I stand in front of this thing.
The reality is that we're probably in a data bubble now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are so many companies from Facebook on all the way down to every little startup that has a big data play as its exit strategy. And data is really just a subset of marketing, and marketing's never taken up more than around 3% of a gross domestic or national product.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's a data crash, I mean, in some ways that's a good thing, but do you see that coming?
It's something that I both fear and hope for. Because like any brush, right? We need to realign ourselves to what is actually going on, because the myth of big data is so rarely challenged. You know, it's almost one-to-one free markets, right? It's like, if there's anything wrong with the free market, it's only because it's not free market enough. Like, and if there's anything wrong with big data, it's because we don't have all of the data yet, but we're just around the corner.
So then you're going to start a book on data skepticism.
Yeah, so I'm working with Catherine D'Ignazio on a very, very, very early stages about data skepticism. So there's so much excitement around data. We want people who are excited about data, excited about visualization of data, analysis of data, advanced algorithms, all of these things, all of this knowledge waiting for us at the tip of our fingers to say, oh, if I'm really excited about this thing, the coolest thing to do right now is data skepticism. Because it's breaking for everybody. Like, everybody has these expectations from data that are not actually met completely. And they follow this free market idea of, oh, I just need to collect a bit more data points and then everything would be fine. But actually, this is exactly the right point to suggest that let's be a bit skeptical about the data, and you'll actually get better analysis, better insights. At the same time, you'll put data in its right place in culture. It's this thing that is valuable. We should not stop doing that, but we should stop thinking that this is, you know, the next step for humanity.
Right, because if anything, if it is a step, it would be a step to mitigate the impact of humanity on reality itself.
Mm-hmm. There's this imagined idea that there's reality as a layer, and then there's another layer that is almost there, which is data. It presents itself through technology and through machines, as if, especially through sensors that are as if objectively collecting the data, right? This is just the way reality speaks to us. Reality speaks to us in zeros and ones. That's kind of the myth of big data. And if we haven't found all of the data in reality, like the idea of data collection, I think I have a problem with the term data collection. It's not there. You're making it. It's data creation.
Or data projection.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of themes, like Catherine that I'm working with has been writing about this and working around these themes. From other perspectives, so she wrote a very interesting article, What Would a Feminist Data Visualization Look Like? So the approach there was like, this is a very this is the way men see the world. Mm-hmm. Like they control everything. Everything has an address, a quantity, and you know, even if we don't go beyond humans, like half of humanity at least have different approaches for this thing. And she's again not suggesting we should not be working with data, but we should put it in its place and use it for what it's good for,
and then celebrate the other side.
Exactly.
And how do we access that?
We access it like we've always accessed it. And because what's happening now is that we're devaluing it. It's back to the my point about the bias against what we cannot quantify. We work with data, and therefore we're more objective, right? That's the way that people collect data about things that humans are doing and they don't understand. So they project data on top of it, and then they say, oh, we can understand that instead, like the clicks, right? The assumption is that if you've clicked something, it means that you're interested in it. Let's play with that. Every opportunity for us to perform, to perform data, to use data as an opportunity, not to put things in their boxes, but actually, you know, create other boxes that are or explore other boxes that have not been created and maybe would never be created. That's life. That's what's so exciting about it.
Right. It almost turns public space into a performance space again.
And yeah. In a way, you can think of data centers as public space. Like that's the furthest thing from public as possible, right? Like the Google ethos of making the world's information globally accessible and exclusively exploitable. We can play there. Every interface is an invitation to expand, right? On one hand, you're being put in a box and you're being told, like, this is the kind of communication that you're doing. You can only like this post. But then what happens if you go and like every post? Yes, it would create, like, crazy responses from everybody. But then what is the next... If somebody liked something that somebody else didn't think they should be liking, what is the next step? Conversation.
So, right. Right, you're doing to the data IP space what algorithms did to the stock market. You know, just go in there and now, you know, 99% of stock market activity is that. It disconnected it from that, you know, so-called reality, but at least it exposed it as the abstraction that it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like a bumper sticker, like a IP on your IP, you know? That's really what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's all in fun, you know?
Yeah, there's something so playful about it. We don't want, I think there are things that you should be very concerned about when it comes to information, and there are opportunities, especially if you're working with extreme situations like activists working in hostile environments, should definitely encrypt their data and hide and do their communication in boxes. But...
they're at war.
Yeah.
That's different. But militarize our public self-expression and our activity,
exactly.
To be told, oh, it's your responsibility as an internet user to have, you know, third-level government, you know...
Yeah, what kind of person are you for not encrypting your emails? Like,
right.
We should not leave our lives. And I think we leave an important percentage of our life is being done through these networks. It should not be under the assumption of war. And if we want to fight back, we should, like, you want to fight back, create more data. Like you're just protecting yourself if you're hiding, which is legitimate when you need to hide, or for people,
right,
who need to hide more than others. And
but
and
the
so
way
on.
To fight back against the hostile environment itself is not through it's not through an arms race,
yeah.
But by almost disempowering the presumption of war through play.
Yeah.
Which is human, you know, and that's really...
And it's playful and it's
that's
fun.
That's the way Team Human fights, you know. So ad nauseum is up and running. We can get this?
Yeah, yeah. We just released version 2, and version 2 is on Chrome and Firefox and other browsers, and you can just go and install it on adnauseum.io.
Cool.
Yeah.
And it's in the App Store? No, it's a...
Yes. Yes. The thing is, we got it on the Google Web Store. Now, it seems like they haven't noticed yet.
Yeah.
And we were just like fixing, we didn't expect it to get there yeah. at all. But then we didn't expect it to happen so fast. And it's there. We just fixed a few bugs. And now we're going to announce it to the world. Now they might take it off, which is a great, great story.
Right.
And they might keep it in, which is a great story. Right?
Yeah, yeah. Win if you lose.
Yeah. Exactly.
Beautiful.
Thanks for joining Team Human. We'll be back in the basement media squat here at the Laboratory for Digital Humanism again next week with new strategies for human intervention in the machine. The show was produced and edited by Stephen Bartolomé.
Thanks to all our supporters and teammates, Zago, who designed our logo and helped kickstart Team Human, Meetup for connecting people out in the real world, start your own meetup at meetup.com, Aaron Dignan at theready.com, and to listener supporters who have made contributions to the Laboratory for Digital Humanism through the website. Our show music is thanks to Fugazi and Mike Watt. My name is Stephen Bartolomé, and I'm on Team Human.
And I'm Douglas Rushkoff. Come visit us at teamhuman.fm, where you'll find more information about our supporters and guests, the work they're doing, resources to get involved, and ways to find the others. Team Human, our last best hope for peeps.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.